Abapala said, "This was a very strange story, to be born again and go in search of the parents of the previous life. It occurs rarely in Sri Lanka. But I was there and saw the child herself identify the parents of her previous birth. She recognized the parents, the brother, the sister, her aunt, her grandmother. I saw with my own eyes how she recognized them, so I accept that as proof." Inside the house, clothes and toys belonging to the dead girl were fetched from the cupboard and Diluxi was invited to inspect them. She recognized not just her parents but her clothes, her school flask, her sunglasses, her slate and pencils. She identified all these and there was a drawing book which she took hold of and turned the pages to a half-finished picture, and then she completed it, Abapala said. Dr. Haraldson was not present at this meeting and for him, this identifying of clothes was unscientific. As a test of recognition it was useless. If we had done it, we would have mixed Shiromi's possessions in with items belonging to other children, and we would have had someone running the test who did not know which items were which. As it was, every time something was picked up, you could say she had identified an object of Shiromi's. Over the fields, behind the house, Diluxi led the way to the river where 9-year-old Shiromi had drowned. Abapala said, "Then she went to the place where she had fallen into the stream. She went there and hit it with stones, threw stones at the water, saying this is the place. Children have a habit of hitting a place where an injury occurred and she did just that. Hence, I believe what she says." For Haraldson the value of Abapala's intervention is that the reporter's notes and published report provided a record of Diluxi's claims, which could confidently be compared to the facts of Shiromi's death, especially since the notes were made before Shiromi's father came forward. See also PDF, Haraldson's, Children Claiming Past Life Memories, 4 Cases in Sri Lanka or Mirror Link Standing on the Riverbank. Haraldson told us the location fitted in well with both versions. Diluxi had said she drowned near a footbridge over a river close to where her father owned paddy fields. Haraldson pointed to the same stretch of water Diluxi had indicated. "This is where Shiromi drowned and there isn't a footbridge here now, but there was in Shiromi's time. And the paddy fields just by here are owned by Shiromi's father." All Diluxi's statements about the stream fit the death of Shiromi. We, BBC, filmed another aspect of Diluxi's tale that described where Shiromi lived. The child remembered 107 playing with her brother on a small outcrop of rock they called the Little Damula Rock and she said from here they could see the roof of their parents' house through the trees. There was a small rocky outcrop halfway between the river and Shiromi's house. We filmed a new generation of children spontaneously playing there, and clearly visible over the treetops was the roof of one house, Shiromi's. It was clear Shiromi's parents accept Diluxi as their daughter returned. We took the child and her parents there, to film the two families together, and they made a party of it. Diluxi was totally at home and brought small presents for the younger brother and sister of her previous life. It was a reunion that was somehow both happy and sad. Haraldson's statistical assessment of the case is that Diluxi made 17 verifiable statements and 13 of them were at least partially correct for the life of Shiromi, but 4 were wrong. The inaccuracies were names of people. For instance, Diluxi gave wrong names for 2 of Shiromi's brothers, although the dead child had playmates with those names. Reincarnation proof. Diluxi Nisanku. As we were leaving, Haraldson confirmed another tie-in between the lives of the two girls. Diluxi had said that near her previous home was a vegetable shop run by a very thin boy. Near Shiromi's home was one shop that fitted the description, but it had closed some years ago. We were taking some shots of it, when the former shopkeeper turned up, quite by chance. He spoke with Haraldson. Yes, he had sold vegetables in those days. Yes, he was known as the Thin Brother. He even remembered the drowned girl Shiromi coming into his shop. Diluxi seemed to have got that right too. Haraldson's other case in Sri Lanka was equally compelling, a little boy who walked about with the gravity of an old man and chanted Buddhist texts in Pali, the ancient language of Sinhalese Buddhism. Do you mind as chanting is the equivalent of a six-year-old Western child chanting parts of the Roman Catholic Mass in Latin? He began this chanting at the age of three, and his mother, the wife of a former bus driver who runs a small poultry farm, was at first anxious to suppress his strange behavior in case the child should leave her and enter a monastery. Today, 3 years on, she is reconciled to the idea, and we were told there are plans for Dewminder to become a boy monk in another year or so. Dewminder was brought up a few miles from Kandy, the old capital of the island and famous as a religious center. There, the Temple of the Tooth houses one of the most famous relics of the Lord Buddha, and nearby is the Asgurya Monastery. The boy has grown up at his grandparents' house. From an early age, he draped a piece of yellow cloth over his shoulder in the fashion of a monk, and made twice daily visits to a small shrine in the area, where he chants Pali texts. He told his family he had been a monk at the Asgurya Temple. His grandfather said, from the age of three, he used to urge us, come on, let's go to the Asgurya Temple. He'd get up early, wrap himself in a towel for a robe and go outside. If he saw a priest going for a bus, he used to cry out, there, the priests are going. I too want to go to the Asgurya, let's go. The child also refused to eat a main meal after 11 o'clock in the morning, as is normal with monks. He was extremely clean and asked his mother not to touch his hands when she helped him to wash. Women are not supposed to touch the hands of a monk. He did not play with other children and asked his family to call him Bodhisadhu or little monk. Dewminder's mother, not surprisingly, sought advice and took the boy to see a monk at a nearby temple, Vajrayana, who told Haraldson that the boy asked for a fan, such as monks use. The child held it in front of his face, in traditional style for a monk, and recited a stanza. The boy told the monk he too had been a monk at Asgurya, and he had a room at the monastery and some belongings there. He wanted to go to see the temple and his motor car. The monk's verdict was that the boy behaved like no other boy, and he did not believe the parents could have taught him this behavior. The monk suggested Dewminder be taken to the Asgurya Monastery. This visit was arranged, and one Sunday in October 1987 Dewminder was taken there. A journalist from the newspaper Island, Oliver Silver, who had heard about the story, was also present. According to the witnesses, the boy seemed to know his way around. He said a traditional prayer at a stupa and told a monk, Vimalakirthi, that he had worshipped there before. The monk asked if he knew where the Bodhi tree was. This special shrine 108 under a tree was only partly visible, above them on a hillside. But unhesitatingly, Dewminder ran up the winding steps to the Bodhi tree. There are 17 residences at the monastery complex, and Dewminder entered the one next to the temple. He said he had lived there before. Inside the building, he was invited to sit down but waited until a white cloth was placed over the seat, as is traditional for a monk. All the monks present agree that the boy had gone upstairs to a large room and identified a bed in a corner as his, and said a large, old wooden box had once been his property, but had not had a lock on it in those days. Dewminder had said he died as a monk after falling down with pains in his chest and being taken to a hospital. The journalist Silver discovered that a senior monk, Vajrayana, had lived in the residence identified by Dewminder, and died of a heart attack in 1975. He concluded the child was this monk reborn. Almost a year later, Haraldson arrived on the scene and sensed that this identification was too hasty. There were some statements by Dewminder which did not fit. There was no evidence that this particular monk owned a red motor car, had an elephant or money and a money bag. The breakthrough came with an old photograph of a dozen monks. Haraldson was told that Dewminder had pointed out someone he knew on that picture, but nobody seemed sure who that had been. Haraldson, who did not know the identity of anyone in the photograph, took it along to Dewminder's home. The small boy pointed to a monk and said, "This was me." Two old monks and the present high priest confirmed the man in the picture had been the chief high priest, Gunepana, who died in 1929. It was the first time Haraldsson had heard this name, but suddenly the facts began to fit. He found that Abbot Gunnepana had had money and a money bag and had been the first monk in Kandy to own a motor car. Two very elderly monks even remembered it as red or brownish. Other pieces of evidence dropped neatly into place. LT was found that a disciple of Gunnepana had owned an elephant, which the old man took a great interest in and regarded as his own. Gunnepana was also famous for his knowledge of religious chants. He had even died of a heart attack, but the two old monks remembered that he died in the monastery and they did not believe he had been taken to hospital, as Dewminder said. There was another seeming mistake. Gunnepana's residence was not the one specified by Dewminder, it was the one next door. It is possible, says Haraldsson, that the monk had lived in a different residence at some earlier stage in his career. The child might also have been confused between buildings that are quite similar on the inside and next door to each other. We filmed Dewminder, watched by Haraldsson, going back to the residence. Again, he went into the same building, climbed the stairs and pointed to where he said he used to sleep. He showed where he used to keep his clothes, but it was still in the wrong house, as far as we could tell. We filmed the child walking home alone from school. He put a piece of cloth over his shoulder and, holding a fan before his face, went to the local shrine and sang some texts in Pali. Next day we went with Dewminder to the temple and there, before the altar, he began chanting more texts. There was some excitement when he chanted a text which the onlookers had not heard before. For a comparison, we went to a nearby monastery and filmed a group of monks whom we asked to chant the seven texts Dewminder had sung. When they came to the little-known chant, only the abbot was able to continue, but he had looked it up in a book beforehand. This text seems to dispose of one theory that Dewminder had picked up his knowledge from an early morning radio program that began with chants at 5 o'clock every day. Haraldsson took a tape to the radio station and they confirmed they had never played this particular chant. But Haraldsson was then told by the grandmother that she and her daughter both knew this chant and several more besides. However, they insisted they have never taught Dewminder any chants. In fact, they say he has taught them one. Dewminder's two brothers, who have been brought up with him, show no signs of any special chanting ability or knowledge of chants. And researcher Godwin Samararatne asked the boy directly, "Where did you learn the chants?" Dewminder's measured reply was, "I have not learned them." Haraldsson is satisfied the only normal explanation for Dewminder's chants in Pali is that he has somehow learned them from his grandmother or mother. On the other hand, Abbot Gunnepana would certainly have known them all, including the little-known chant which is sung mainly in the Temple of the Tooth, Kandy, where Gunnepana was in charge. These four children, along with the others we filmed in India and Canada, together made an impressive statement on behalf of the parapsychologists whose work they represent. Of course, today's skeptical scientists are not particularly impressed with spectacular individual cases, which might be caused by chance or freak circumstance. They prefer the safe statistical conclusions which can be drawn from large numbers of similar cases. The good news is that Dr. Stevenson and his colleagues have done all that. What I have written about is just the tip of their statistical iceberg. There are hundreds of other similar cases, analyzed with tables and charts and statistics in the academic papers and books the individual scientists have published, and there is more to come. There are even parapsychologists in this area whose work I haven't mentioned so far, like Dr. J. Urgen Keel of the 109 University of Tasmania, who has investigated reincarnation claims in countries such as Thailand, Burma and Turkey. A good case for reincarnation as a form of survival after death seems to have already been made out. The problem is that the critics seize on the weakest aspect of any case, which the parapsychologists as good scientists always include, and publicly deride that part of the material and pretend the rest of the evidence doesn't exist. The case for survival is stronger than is generally realized. There is even a range of relevant circumstantial evidence about science and the nature of reality, which we haven't touched on yet. Still more on reincarnation articles, http://jamesmotlock.com/wp-content/uploads/2021/02/sci-encyclopedia-articles on reincarnation 3.pdf 110 chapter 25. Quantum leap: the concepts WHGH now prove to be fundamental to our understanding of nature seem to my mind to be structures of pure thought. The universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine. Sir James Jeans. Half a century ago, quantum physicists exploded the idea that the universe is a predictable place whose secrets are well understood by the scientific heirs to Sir Isaac Newton. What was perceived as reality is now a great mystery. The old materialist theory was that all matter obeyed cause and effect laws like balls on a billiards table. Quantum physicists, looking at matter on the micro scale of atoms and electrons, found the old rules for billiards did not apply. Matter is patterns of energy, electrons can behave like waves, and nuclear particles fired from a common source in two different directions, no matter how far apart, are somehow still in touch. Any change to one set of particles causes a similar change in the other, action at a distance. Also, the observer seems to influence his own experiment, altering the result just by watching. Matter was perhaps responding to consciousness or mind. It was all very paranormal. It was so contrary to established science that even Albert Einstein in 1935 was unhappy with the implications of spooky actions at a distance. If an observer was producing a physical reality just by watching, Einstein asked if it meant the moon was there only when he looked at it. Today, quantum theory is understood by so few people and the speculative theories are so strange and controversial that most of us know little or nothing about them. Some scientists are happy with this state of general ignorance. They pretend quantum doesn't exist and they have all the answers. For them, the old laws of nature are still intact and not a bucket with a hole in the bottom. The fear of some hardliners is that any scientific acceptance of action at a distance or mind affecting matter opens the door to the world of psi and even the possibility of survival. On the other hand, some scientists, familiar with quantum and the best research in parapsychology, see the need for a new science, perhaps free from the old straitjacket of no-go areas imposed at the time of the Reformation. Quantum has demonstrated that the old mechanistic ideas about reality and the universe have only limited validity. But there is still no overall theory to put in their place, even after 50 years, although there are some exciting alternatives. For instance, one quantum effect is that matter can appear to be in two places at the same time, so there is a theory of parallel universes. There might be alternative worlds to our own, near mirror images of our lives taking place in a dimension we are unaware of. Now that is what I call spooky. Also, because consciousness comes into the quantum equations, comparisons have been made with Eastern mysticism, and there is the suggestion that reality might be thought itself or consciousness, which might explain paranormal phenomena like psi, as well as apparitions and even survival. To learn more about quantum and these fascinating speculations, I went to several experts, including the 1973 Nobel Prize winner for physics, Professor Brian Josephson of the Cavendish Laboratory, Cambridge. He told me it was sometimes assumed that quantum effects occurred only on the smallest subatomic scale, but in superconductivity experiments, electromagnetic tests at low temperatures, he had witnessed it on a scale big enough to see. Quantum has made the whole world seem very mysterious and almost unvisualizable. It is incomprehensible even to the scientists. We can only make calculations and predict the results of experiments. We don't have a clear mental picture of what is going on. What kind of hypotheses are currently available to explain these quantum effects? For a lot of people, it is sufficient to make equations which seem to explain nature. But the mysterious thing is that the observer himself has to be put into the physics to get answers out. Different people have different attitudes to all of this, and you could say the theory is not completely logical. One speculation is the idea there are a lot of parallel universes. Another is that mind is ensuring there is only one universe at a time. A theory popular amongst some people is there is a sort of hidden reality 111 behind that which we can see. That's a very interesting hypothesis because, if you try and explain what you see in terms of a hidden reality, you find you can't explain what is observed without putting in action at a distance. This is significant because experiments on things like telepathy suggest there really may be action at a distance. ATM does all this put mind or man, however we define ourselves, more at the center of things? Well, it suggests that maybe mind is important. There's another line of reasoning which people call the anthropic principle. There are a large number of coincidences necessary for life to exist. For example, if certain numbers didn't work out right, the universe wouldn't last long enough for life to have evolved. The universe would expand so quickly you couldn't get the kind of world we have. One way of explaining these coincidences is to say that mind is in the background keeping its eye on things and adjusting the properties of the universe so that it will be right for some future life. Does this tend towards the possibility of survival? If you wanted an explanation for survival in science, you could call upon a number of things. The fact that according to some versions of physics, the observer has to be put in. Or you might say the universe is a lot more subtle than we thought, and so there may be some kind of energy that could survive death. At the moment, science is fairly neutral, I would say, on the possibility of survival. We know that nature is not just lumps of matter, it's some kind of energy pattern. So, in principle, survival would be possible if some kind of energy pattern could survive the absence of a body to support it. But that's purely speculative at the present time. Is it a realistic question that man might be a thought form in a universe that was made of thought? It has been suggested by some people that the universe is made of thought. The scientist says everything is made up out of fields. It's somewhat parallel that a field might be a thought and then you could arrive at the conclusion that everything is made of thought. Certainly things are not made up out of particles, so I think to show it was made up of thought, you'd need to show that something like a thought process was going on, and we really don't have that picture yet. But we do have some sense that observation might help to construct reality, and that comes close to the idea that thought is involved in the nature of reality. How would you compare scientific speculation today about the nature of reality, and the insights that religion claims to have? How certain can we be about scientific values? Well, there are all sorts of things that scientists claim that are really acts of faith, just as much as religious belief. When a scientist says, for example, we understand how the brain works, or we understand how man came into existence through natural selection, that's an enormous extrapolation. The kind of thing that happens is somebody writes a computer program that can understand simple sentences and then says, we understand the principle of language and so we understand how our minds work. Similarly, somebody produces a theory which explains a little piece of evolution, like changes in color of a moth as the background changes, and scientists may then say, we understand how evolution works. To apply this to the evolution of man or to say how man's mind works involves an enormous leap of faith, which I'd say is almost bigger than the kind of faith involved in religious belief. Some people have the idea that science is reaching its climax, and will soon find the right equation that will explain everything. But I don't think we are in that sort of situation, because I don't think we really understand mind. That, in turn, means we don't really understand life. Neither does science really take into account the concept of meaning. Science has advanced a lot in the direction of taking things to bits, but it's not advanced nearly so far in finding out how things work as a whole. I think science will ultimately have to move in this direction. It may have to develop new means of exploring nature in this direction, and I don't mean new tools. What about parallels in Buddhism, in mysticism, to aspects of quantum theory? They seem to have been saying some approximately similar things. 112 You have to be a little careful in trying to connect science and mysticism. Some features of mysticism can be connected quite well with properties discovered by science, but I think mysticism goes beyond science. I believe aspects of nature, deeper than those discovered by science, are understood in mysticism. It's as if science has just scratched the surface of the mind-like aspects of nature. And because mind is fundamentally more elusive than matter, the methods of science have so far failed to grasp the subtleties in the way mystical experience has. In the last decade, there's been a lot of talk among ordinary people about connections between science and mysticism. The reaction of a vast number of scientists has been to say this is nonsense, it's pseudoscience. I think this is a wrong conclusion, and we will in future see this kind of thing becoming routine science. The statement is often made that when something unorthodox comes up, scientists first of all ignore it and then say it's nonsense. Eventually they say it's obvious, and it was obvious all the time. I think we'll get that happening in the areas that you're exploring in your program. Chapter 26. Scientific no-go areas. Newton, forgive me. You found the only way that, in your day, was at all possible for a man of the highest powers of intellectual creativity. The concepts that you created still dominate the way we think in physics, although we now know that they must be replaced, if we want to try for a more profound understanding of the way things are interrelated. Albert Einstein. Is there life after death? Is the question which has been a no-go area for science for 300 years. There is a modern scientific assumption that we are machines made of flesh, which crumble to nothingness at death, but the mass of scientific research directly addressing the question is by parapsychologists and fellow travelers, the sort of people mentioned in this book, who frequently come to very different conclusions. So, who is right? Classical science has sat on the fence since the 17th century, when Galileo, Descartes and Newton agreed that consciousness lay outside the remit of science. Our subjective reactions to the environment were non-scientific and irrelevant to the scientific task of measuring and analyzing the objective realities of the universe. Descartes defined all a scientist needs to know out consciousness: I think, therefore I am. Nowadays, the cracks are apparent in the great edifice of Reformation science, which brought order and reason to the collection of curiosities of medieval science. Einstein and relativity and the effects of quantum physics have shown that the observer cannot be left out of modern scientific equations, and many informed minds today are seeking a new branch of science, perhaps a science of the mind. Are we on the brink of an historic scientific change? I talked to the consultant neuropsychiatrist Dr. Peter Fenwick. The science we have today is basically Reformation science, dealing with shape, motion, weight and so on. Subjective qualities like redness, love, truth, beauty are non-scientific, and that has been a principle of our science. The whole of neuroscience is brain function. The five senses are not represented in science, only the pathways, the area of the brain in which the five senses are structured and how they come into consciousness. What is not represented is the quality of the experience itself. One theory is that we don't need anything else, because qualities are just the brain's subjective view, in other words the internal view, a model or representation. But the people who hold that view have no way of explaining it directly. So science describes the mechanism and describes it beautifully. But it can't attempt to explain qualities. It cannot explain this rich, perceptual world in which we live. We recognize the brain as a machine, and know a great deal about its structure. We can talk about a red patch of light which strikes the retina, which then comes through the optic nerve to the cortex at the back of the brain. And there science stops, puts its finger to its mouth and is silent. We cannot talk about redness because that is non-scientific and there is no theory. This follows from what Galileo said, so we talk about movement 113 and chemical change, but not about the subjective experience of redness. Can existing sciences be expanded to cope with these questions, or do we need a new science? We certainly need new science to understand the true nature of the universe. Our comment: and this spiritual science is already here, but it is still quite unknown outside the North, Scandinavia. Here is the link to this info.x. Watch this video link YouTube. The mechanical aspects of the universe we've now got nearly tied up. In terms of the nature of man and his subjective experience, we haven't even begun.